Let's do.
It is Thursday, May 13th at 5 p.m., so we are going to get underway. You are at panel number 4904 at the Conference on World Affairs. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us, especially at 5 p.m. on a beautiful Spring Boulder afternoon. I'm really glad you chose to come here and listen to this wonderful panel and engage in some great discussion about protecting those most vulnerable among us. My name is Betsy Martins. I am the moderator of this panel. I am the executive director of Boulder Housing Partners. We are the housing authority in the city of Boulder, and we have a bit of a specialty in serving homeless and chronically homeless people, so I know a little bit about vulnerability. I was also part of the U.S. delegation to the World Urban Forum in Milan in 2011, where we talked a lot about vulnerability in that international setting. So this is a topic very near and dear to my heart. Before I introduce the panelists, let me tell you a little bit about what we're going to do. If you've been to a number of these sessions, it might look familiar. Each of our panelists will begin with opening remarks. And after those, I will encourage some conversation among the panelists to get them to react to each other and talk among themselves. And then we will open it up to your questions. Because we're in this setting, we are Wi-Fi enabled, and so we will take your questions in one of two ways, either through the app. How many of you have the conference app and are comfortable asking questions through the app? A couple of you. And otherwise, Elizabeth and Katie are our session producers, and they have note cards, and just wave your hand and they will get you a note card so we can get your questions. If you are a student, please write student on somewhere in your either your app or your card so that we be sure to prioritize your questions first. So let's get underway. You are here to hear something interesting. Let me introduce very quickly our panelists. Their full bios are in the program or on your app, so I certainly won't repeat those. But let me give you a couple of highlights. To my immediate left, let's please welcome Deliana Garcia. And she is, yeah, let's applaud. They spend a lot of their time to come here and be with us. Deliana is the Director of International Projects Research and Development at the Migrant Clinicians Network. She is an expert in migration health and culturally competent care, and Deliana joins us from Austin, Texas. To her left is Mei Ling McNamara. Mei Ling is an assistant professor here at, thank you. If I forget to prompt the applause, please prompt your own. Assistant professor at CU and a journalist with a focus on human rights reporting and social justice issues, and she comes to us from our hometown here in Boulder, Colorado. And to her left, Bill Ryerson. Bill is the founder and president of Population Media Center, and he also serves as the chair and CEO of the Population Institute. And he joins us from Shelburne, Vermont, which is where I moved from 32 years ago when I came to Boulder. So nice to have a fellow Vermonter on the panel. And with that, we're going to follow the order in which our panelists are seated. So I'm going to turn it right over to Deliana.
Great. Thank you all so much for, as she said, being here with us on a beautiful afternoon where when you just look outside, you sort of feel drawn out into the space. So I'm glad that you were willing to be in here where there are a few options to look at the sunny outside. When I looked at the topic of protecting the most vulnerable, then it left me with a sense of, in my own thinking, as I'm trying to do my work and as I'm trying to view the world around me and I'm considering how it is that I interact in the things that are most urgent to me in terms of migration and health, I realize that I really think about it in three separate ways. That there's the large-scale issue of vulnerability, and that's really situational. I look at those who are labor vulnerable, and those who are education vulnerable, and housing vulnerable, and healthcare access vulnerable, and that they don't often intersect, and yet sometimes they do. Someone who is homeless is certainly struggling with that. They may have difficulty finding and accessing health care. It could be that there's been an absence of education. Their immigration status may be an issue. And so the intersection of all of those areas of vulnerability can be huge and at a large scale. But then I also look at it from the individual. What each person that I'm trying to work with, I work a great deal with individuals who've been affected by infectious disease, and they're having to migrate. And what does it mean to move across the globe while you're being treated for TB disease? And can you access healthcare in the new point where you will be trying to live? Is there going to be any restriction to you receiving medications? Do they require that you are not only a resident but perhaps a citizen? And all of those vulnerabilities have a huge effect on the work that I'm doing. And then of late, I've really looked at my own personal vulnerability from two ways. My 83-year-old mother lives with me now, something that when I was much younger, I never presumed would go on. And I see her fragility and advancing fragility that I had never presumed would be the case. My mother was forever young and vital in my mind, as I am, until I take a good hard look at myself in the mirror, and then I'm sort of struck by the person that I've become. But it has given me the opportunity to think about personal vulnerability in a very different way. And then there's been an additional layer of personal vulnerability that I've looked at recently. And as a Mexican woman, a woman of Mexican descent, living in Texas, what I confront now in terms of the type of racism that I never experienced when I was younger has made it very clear to me how truly vulnerable I am. Because I am a woman of color who now with white hair is seen as much older, living in a state where politically the situation is really charged, enormously volatile, and you have the right to carry a gun. And not only do you have the right to carry a gun, it doesn't have to be concealed. You can carry it on the outside. And so when I look at the environment now in which I live my daily life, and the life that my mother is living, and the fact that I have a 28-year-old son who, for better or for worse, because there have been moments that I've been really grateful, looks white, I have to think about vulnerability very differently than I had ever done so before. And that vulnerability now, I understand for many people, is situational. And in the situation that you find yourself at that moment, your vulnerability quotient can go way up or it can come down. And depending on where you are safe and depending on where you understand the circumstances and the flow of power, your vulnerability is much reduced. But in a place where you don't have standing, where you're not clear on the circumstances, mm-hmm. where you cannot predict the next thing that's going to occur, then your vulnerability quotient can really peg the meter. And what I also understand is that as I'm walking through life, trying to make that assessment for myself, everyone around me is doing the same thing. And so all of us are moving in our little individual spheres, looking at our own vulnerability, advancing vulnerability. We're trying to be concerned with our communities and those individuals within it who also have an increasing vulnerability or a high rate of vulnerability. And then we're trying to be compassionate human beings on the planet and focusing out into the larger world and understanding what the degree of vulnerability out there is that we are watching people live through or that through our own action or inaction are contributing to. So now my own political activity is really starting to make it clear to me that I can affect the environment in which my own vulnerability is affected. I live in a red state. I live in one of the reddest states in the world. Am I doing enough to confront that political situation? And then I look at it, the work that I do, international migration, and that what is causing or creating the need for people to move and to migrate, and do I have a clear enough understanding of human migration and the necessity for it? It's an eventuality, and so am I being responsive? And then am I looking at the larger political environment? And that is heady stuff. in a day-to-day moment where the best that I can do is get up, take a shower, make sure I've got clean clothes on, and get a cup of coffee before I bolt out the door, to really contemplate vulnerability is one of those things that could paralyze you and can certainly paralyze me. And so from my perspective, the issue is to try and be open to understanding how mutable our sense of security is, you know, and how rapidly our own sense of vulnerability can be increased, to be mindful of the role that I play, and to really exercise care in understanding that the person who is confronting me or is standing in front of me may be looking at circumstances that I don't even understand. And I certainly didn't have this perspective in my 20s, 30s, 40s. It's now when I'm 60 that I think I'm finally getting the hang of it. But that is, I think, the work in front of us, is to understand the movement of each individual's stand in and out of vulnerability and what that does for them. Because what I see from my mother is that it also increases her sense of fear. And the response you get from individuals from fear is very different than the response that you get from them from security and courage. Now, my mother's a really courageous woman, but that's not the same as being courageous and afraid, and being courageous and confident and secure that you know how things work. So in this conversation about protecting the most vulnerable, I really do want to hear from my co-panelists about their view on who it is that they think about when that phrase comes up, and where it is that they might see those of us who are also trying to be thoughtful in our view of vulnerability need to be focusing our attention, if there's a way to do that. Because I feel like in this discussion, I need some guidance. Thank you.
It's Deliani. Call me Del.
Well, thank you very much, Del. That was really powerful. Thank you. So just to kind of build on from that, I just want to introduce a little bit about myself and some of the work that I do as a journalist. I started getting involved in investigative journalism the last sort of 10 years, doing documentary and print journalism. And what I really gravitated towards was a lot of human rights and social justice issues. And what really ended up kind of the stories that sort of came about, I mean, I worked on stories of those sort of dealing with particulates from the biggest open pit mine in the world in Utah, to Vietnamese children that were trafficked for cannabis cultivation in the UK, to migrants in the hotel industry from Bangladesh in Scotland, to the diaspora of Libyans suffering from torture. So I sort of, you know, covered a broad range of people and issues, but I just really wanted to talk a little bit about today about my work on human trafficking and modern-day slavery. Because as you say, there's so many different groups that are vulnerable, and with this particular group, I've worked on with these individuals. They are individuals. They are not one group for nearly a decade now, and it takes a certain type of I don't say that only certain types of journalists can do it, but it takes a certain type of journalist to do it in a way that I think is protecting the best way they can. I don't know how familiar people are with the issue of human trafficking, but essentially it is people who are not necessarily moving across borders, they can be trafficked within borders, but are doing some form of forced, coerced, deceptive, or being deceived in some form of labor, sex, against their will. And against their will can mean a number of things. It could be forced, but it could be something like debt bondage. And when we talk about vulnerability, we can talk, everyone knows what money can do, right? So we talk about vulnerabilities of debt, vulnerabilities of lack of status, right? We talk about immigration, lack of language, and fear. And so I just wanted to talk a bit about a case study that an investigation I worked on that generated a lot of support from the public and a lot of media attention. I wrote a big feature and did a lot of different multimedia for the Guardian newspaper. It's a British paper, but also has a U.S. arm. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the pitfalls and some of the difficulties navigating things as a journalist, because I want to talk a little bit about journalist ethics and the idea of minimizing harm. balancing that with the public's right to know. And particularly around human trafficking, one of the big issues with traffickers is that they want to take people from the furthest thing that they know. Their MO basically is to rip people away from their roots, from their leverage, from their power, and to create vulnerability, okay? To create a very high level of vulnerability. And that may be vulnerable to criminals, but also to governments, okay? So, you know, a lot of these people came from Bangladesh. They paid the equivalent of $30,000. They sold their family's jewels. They sold their family's lands, all on a promise for a better life. Now, who wouldn't want to do that? Many people think that that is naive, and perhaps it might be, but many people in America came here on the promise of a better life. So when you look at all the circumstances, sometimes you make the best situation or decision that you'd make at the time under what kind of options you have. So people came over, and I covered a group of four men, one in particular. His name is Azad, and his name is public, so you can find it. And they came over to a hotel in Scotland to ostensibly work as chefs, and they got visas, and they were legal, and they were working. And when they got and they arrived, the Bangladeshi owner told them, who's also British, that your contract is not the contract you're having. It's actually a second contract I have, which is going to be a fraction of what you're going to make, which is not you paying this off in 2 years, but maybe forever. He says, you know, I know all the visa people. I know you can get deported in a heartbeat. I can pull your visa, and I don't have to pay you back. So we're talking about the average person maybe making $1,000 a year in Bangladesh is the average cost of living. So if you paid $30,000, that's your life. So you are now stuck for life. And we had people leaving their children and family back home to make a living. So this is the kind of stories I had to cover. And I followed these men for 4 years. I made a documentary, and I wrote a feature piece. And what was really troubling and difficult was not only writing the story, but getting people to believe that these men were vulnerable. Because there's a lot of perceptions of migrants, as you know. They came over here with the full and total disclosure that this is their life and whatever happens to them, they deserve. That they were men and men aren't vulnerable. And obviously that's not true. A lot of different kind of, you know, mythologies. And that was also, you know, kind of helping these men get a status. And I cover this story, and it was an intense story. And what kind of came of it as well was that these men suffered from varying degrees of trauma. Trauma that doesn't really go recognized. I'm not a doctor, but I studied trauma as part of my doctorate at the University of Edinburgh as part of a media trauma and law, and recognizing certain elements of trauma. So as a journalist, ethically, you have to be incredibly careful. You have to balance out their need to tell their story every week, every month, and the acknowledgement and disclosure of where this story may end up, and the need to be seen. There is a power in the face. There is a power in a name. But at the same time, you know, is being anonymous better? Who are you serving? And so I had to balance out the being visible and invisible for these men. They wanted to be visible so that the government wouldn't deport them, even though they had been identified as trafficked. They didn't want to be invisible because they didn't want to be killed by the trafficker or all the people back home in Bangladesh that were after them. But if they showed their faces, then everyone would know who they were, and everyone would know where to find them. So it was incredibly difficult, and I can't say that I still know if I did the right thing. Which was that the men, one of the main men wanted to come out forward and do that because he did not want to be pushed under the carpet. Just to kind of talk a little bit about the journalistic ethics around covering human rights issues and stories, you know, there is that balance of trying to give someone a voice and a name and the ability to tell their story and a platform and a narrative that no one else had given them, no one else had asked. But there was also that need throughout for me to protect the men. I would tell them, if the local news wants to talk to you, it wasn't about me getting the scoop or anything like that. I didn't care about that. But, you know, if you don't feel comfortable with it, you know, you talk to me, you know, I can help, or you talk to your solicitor. Because what ended up happening was they were told, asked again and again for their stories, but left in this way that no one cared, that it was just their story that people cared about, not really helping them. So I think, you know, trying to balance that out, and also just, you know, being really, really aware of your ethics as a journalist, you know. It isn't just about making the public informed. It is about allowing a person to be seen, and how much is a constant conversation of informed consent. So I just wanted to give you a little insight into the work that I've done and some of the difficulties I've navigated through that. And yeah, I look forward to talking with everyone about this. Thank you.
I've been thinking, as I think all of our panelists have been thinking, about two aspects related to the topic of this seminar. One is, how do we define those most vulnerable? And then the second one is, therefore what? What do we do about it? And certainly, we've not surprisingly heard already a litany of some of the horrors of human behavior, and probably if you think back over the sweep of human history, there are too many to even imagine. But as an ecologist, when I think about those most vulnerable, I think about other species. They have no voice. They have been reclassified by Lord Man as natural resources for our use. But indeed, as Eileen Christ has written most eloquently, they have the right to exist in their own right. And, of course, human behavior is causing mass extinction as we expand into wilderness habitat for more and more farming and more housing as the population grows. And we have, as a society, given very little thought to preserving these animals and plants in their own right. I think what is starting to get people's attention is the fact that 3 billion years of evolution of the web of life is what makes the planet habitable, and if we systematically destroy it, as we are doing, then we are fried. So certainly that, I think, is something that often gets left out of discussions of those most vulnerable, but that's because they're not at this table, and they can't represent themselves. So I think this is an amazing crowd, by the way, to come to 5 o'clock to hear about the horrors of human behavior, but at any rate, I admire you for doing it. Within the human population, I think my perspective, working in the work that I do in international development, and particularly with regard to gender and reproductive health issues, is the physically and mentally disabled, and women and girls as a category are extremely vulnerable. And I'll give you a couple of examples. In Uganda and Kenya, for example, women with a college education competing with literally thousands of applicants for a clerk job will be required to sleep with the owner of the store to get the job. And then when it's paycheck time, they'll be required to sleep with them again. And the lack of policy and the lack of enforcement, if there is any policy with regard to such exploitation of people, puts these people at terrible risk. So one of the things that is critically important in addressing those most vulnerable is effective policymaking, and certainly the United States has done a lot of this, soul-searching and policymaking, although certainly there are those who want to undo those policies. But then the other thing is changing mentality. So I think on the therefore what, a large piece of the answer is communications. getting people to rethink what are they doing. For example, we're now, Population Media Center, the organization I run, now proposing to do a primetime soap opera on Central Chinese television to make it unpopular to give or display ivory carvings, because ivory carvings are now a status symbol in China. People seal business deals by giving an ivory carving. People achieve status by showing off their ivory carvings, and elephants in Africa are facing extinction in our lifetimes. So the money involved allows the poachers to hire helicopters and guys with machine guns and go out there and slaughter whole herds of 80 elephants at a time. So we're facing the loss of elephants, rhinos, and many other iconic species and species that are not iconic that nobody really pays any attention to. But thinking how do we stop human behavior from destroying those species is critically important. Second, in Nepal, the former president of Nepal, the first president after the monarchy, came to launch two radio soap operas that were broadcasting nationwide to stop child marriage. Nepal has among the highest rates of child marriage, and unless you happen to think this is just girls, it's boys and girls in Nepal. The president was married at 14, his bride was 12. They had no say in the matter. They were married as children. And as he said at the launching ceremony, this practice has to stop. So we have characters in a long-running melodrama designed to change mentality about this issue. In Nigeria, we received a letter from a woman named Halima Abdulsami. And I'll tell you her story, and then I'll stop. The Rotary Clubs of Northern Nigeria decided to fund a surgical center to repair obstetric fistula. And in case you're like me and didn't know what the heck that was, it's a medical term that means a hole. Fistula means a hole. An obstetric fistula means an obstetric hole that often results from obstructed labor that, if it goes on long enough, destroys enough tissue that it leaves the woman incontinent or unable to control bodily functions. Now, in northern Nigeria, it's not uncommon for girls to be sold by their parents into marriage at 9 and 10 years old. They have no concept of women's rights, human rights, anything else. They're being brought up by their husbands, raped every night, working in the kitchen, no education. So Halima was one of these women. And like the 800,000 women with unrepaired fistula, once she started leaking urine after having obstructed labor, she was thrown out of the house by her husband. It's much easier to get a new wife than to repair the old one. And there were several other wives. So, you know, there are 800,000 women roughly living on the streets of Nigeria who have unrepaired fistula. So we said to the Rotary Clubs, look, we'll be happy to do a soap opera that'll make people aware of this surgical center. But there's an upstream issue here. We're going to also address child marriage and family planning. And they said, fine. So we broadcast 208 episodes across Kano and Kaduna. You may have read about them because of the kidnap of the 300 adolescent girls. It's a tough neighborhood. In fact, during the workshop, there was gunfire in the streets outside the training workshop for the scriptwriters. So we've now moved our scriptwriting training and studio to Abuja. But the program went on the air, and a character named Kande tried to deliver a baby at age 15, obstructed labor, killed the baby, and left Kande incontinent, and she was thrown out by her husband, and she went to the surgical center funded by the Rotary Clubs in Zaria and had a repair and lived happily ever after. So that's 208 episodes in one sentence. And Halima Abdulsami had the same thing, except the baby survived. The husband threw her out, and she went home to her parents' house. They put her in an isolation hut on their land where she sat leaking urine day and night, and somebody would bring her food. And after some months, her husband brought her a radio set, and he said, there's a woman on the radio who has the same problem you have, and you ought to listen to what's going on. So she followed Conde's life and listened as Conde went to the surgical center in Zaria and got repaired and came to that same surgical center and said, I want what Conde had. And they repaired her, and she was reunited with her family. And she was one of 54% of all women seeking that surgery who named the program when they were asked what motivated their visit to the surgical center. At family planning clinics at the same time, one-third of family planning clients, when asked what caused you to come to the clinic, named that same program. So, indeed, there's huge promise to address attitudinal and behavioral issues affecting the most vulnerable, and to, indeed, among men who are often the perpetrators of various forms of violence, change their own attitude about what masculinity means and change their attitude about the humanity of women and girls. Thank you very much.
You all have done a remarkable picture of painting, a remarkable job of painting us a picture of the breadth and depth of vulnerability. Everything from Dell talking about personal vulnerability in a new age of politics, and human trafficking and refugees, and then Bill introducing the idea of species vulnerability. So we're really broad. I'm interested in your thoughts about, Bill, your suggestion that there needs to be policy intervention, yet your work and Mei Ling's work is about telling the story. And so let's talk a little bit about that difference between where can governments intervene with policy, and where do we all have a role in either writing stories, telling stories, sharing stories, reacting to stories, you know, maybe around strategies. Where do we get personal power, and where do we rely on governments to help?
You know, the United Nations has been a marvelous institution despite some level of bureaucracy, because through the UN Declaration of Human Rights, the Cairo Program of Action on Population and Development, the Beijing Plan of Action on Women's Rights, and the Earth Summit Declaration with regard to environmental protection, the UN has really given humanity a code of human conduct. And many governments have taken many of those policies and institutionalize them in their constitution or their laws or their policy statements. And indeed, while many countries still have a long way to go in doing things like outlawing child marriage or other policy gaps, in many ways the biggest gap is getting from the boardroom of the parliament to the bedroom of the people. So, for example, and some of you, forgive me if you've heard this story because I've told it in a couple of other panels, a way to get human rights across to people is through storytelling. They may not know what the law is. So we got a letter from a woman in southern Ethiopia, in Oromia, saying, thank you very much for your program and for addressing the issue of marriage by abduction. Our own daughter was abducted on her way to school at age 14 and ended up married as a result, and people won't take the daughter home after she's been raped because they think it'll bring shame on the family, so they force her to live with her rapist the rest of her life. And at the time we did this program, the Ethiopian Women's Law Association said one woman who had the temerity to take her rapist to court pleaded with the judge to set her free, and the judge turned to the man. He said, do you love the woman? He said, yeah, I love her. And he said, go home with him. He loves you. End of case. Now they're throwing these guys in jail. And what happened? Well, this story, as this letter, I'll go back to the letter. So she said, thank you for dealing with this issue of marriage by abduction. Our daughter was abducted at age 14 and ended up married as a result. And we've been afraid to send the 12-year-old girls to school for fear the same thing would happen to them. When you address this issue through the character Wu Balam, our entire village was listening. This was a huge hit. We had about half the population listening. And our village came together after those episodes to discuss this issue, and we all agreed to enforce the law against marriage by abduction, which we had not known existed. And now it's safe for the 12-year-old girls to go to school. So storytelling is a very important way to get people to understand what the policy is.
I just want to add, and I absolutely agree with you, not only because I do that as a job, but I would say that giving Azad, who was in our story, the feature, he was the main character, he was the person, and all his quotes was him really telling his own story, was so powerful in the feature that we wrote that the response was more than a news story would get. We had it was in a feature magazine issue, The Guardian, that when you talk about policy change, you know, we really tried to hit it on looking at the Modern Slavery Act that the UK government had just brought in to say, you know, and this is part of that, and they sort of failed in their responsibilities. But also the public response to it was so great. It was overwhelming. Not only did people respond to and comment, but people sort of wrote to us and said, how can we help? And, you know, in a time where there's a lot of fear of migrants and, you know, Brexit and everything at that time was going on, it was actually overwhelming to see that most comments, and yes, some are moderated, but most comments were hugely positive and empathetic to their lives. And then someone just decided to start a Kickstarter campaign and raise $35,000 for the men to support their legal fees, which is nothing that I wanted to be involved in because that would go into advocacy, but I told them that they're very welcome to do it themselves. So I think in terms of empathy, storytelling is really powerful, and also giving a face or a name to somebody and telling their story, allowing them to like really have their quotes and their story, really is something that can take the shame off the individual that it's happened to and put more shame on governments and people that are not allowing them to have a fair hearing, you know. So.
And what, as I'm sitting here listening to these wonderful examples, what occurs to me then is, because you've continued, each of you, to use the word, is the whole issue of power. And that what is truly the case is that there are individuals who are seeking power, want power, but counter that then in terms of policies or governments or individuals are those who are really unwilling to relinquish power. And that I think that that is the confrontation regularly that we see, that those methods that we create for individuals to understand their own power, to regain it or to gain it if they've never had it at all, and to exercise it well, because I think very often what happens is my own capacity to save myself means that I do not create a space for someone else to be saved with me. But always it is in the face of that pushback from those who are unwilling to relinquish the power. And that's a difficult ground. You guys are doing some incredible work.
I just want to add one thing.
This is your panel. Do you talk?
I agree with you. It's easy to dehumanize people when they don't have a face or a name. And if we look at all the movements in most recent times, it's been a name and a person, and a singular person. Even like tragically, like a child that's died on a beach, right? That we've heard these stories so many times, but until we can identify as one individual to another, then we really act as a people. So I think that's really vital. I just want to add that. Mm-hmm.
There's a related question for you, Mei Ling. When as a journalist, when you've invited somebody to share their vulnerability, what do you do to help protect them?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I mentioned the idea of informed consent, but there is also that idea, which is, of course, you tell a person what you're doing, the possible consequences of them sharing this, where it would go. But I don't think informed consent is one conversation. I think it is many, many conversations over many periods of time as the story changes. But it's also important for the journalist to maintain a strong relationship with the narrative. I may write the story or film the story, but ultimately there is the story is disseminated through a broadcaster or a newspaper, and there's an editor at the end of the line. And I have to be in control of that narrative so that that person is given that protection. At the same time, too, I think it's just important to just remain vigilant about their safety, not just safety in terms of imminent danger of their person, but their psychological safety as well. I think that that's something that even though you may not be a clinician or a doctor, as a journalist, you have to have empathy and understand when you've pushed somebody too much. And we've all seen tragic events where the journalists are callous and not properly doing their jobs in that way just to get the story. And I think that you have to be incredibly vigilant at all times of that. So.
But I think being vigilant to care for someone and not being callous, absolutely. What I think I've seen in healthcare, so not to say that it has a parallel in journalism, is that that desire to not be callous, to be empathetic, to making sure that you are monitoring the situation, has also resulted in a removal of agency from the person who's trying to act. And it's all well-intentioned. It is out of my goodness and an understanding of what they need that I am then acting. And what it has resulted in then is a removal of some of that person's ability to take what they have started generating on their own and move forward, because somehow it moves away, that person moves away. Mm. You know, so I think it's
To add to that, and I don't know if this is something similar, but one of the things journalists often come up against is, and I think rightly so, is NGOs that work with survivors, right? So they will often never let you meet somebody who's a survivor, because they say, well, you know, we don't want them to speak to the media. And I think in some ways that there should be, and the way it's worked in the past is, well, leave it up to them. If they're an adult, they can talk with me and they can get to know me, mm-hmm. and then I can work with the third party mm-hmm. who can monitor it and just make sure that they're safeguarding mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. But I think closing them down and not allowing them to reach the public is actually, someone else is actually can be detrimental.
Can be,
you know.
The issue of agency is an interesting one in another respect, which is this is also something that can be taught through storytelling. So I know many people who say, well, I'm unemployed because God wants me unemployed, or I'm in poverty because God wants me in poverty. And somebody, a Mexican telenovela producer, once said to me, you know, the benefit the U.S. has is you've got Benjamin Franklin. And so I took that to mean you really need to shift fatalistic societies into self-efficacy, where people think, yeah, I have the right and the ability to do whatever this is that I need to do, where they don't rely on some other being or their spouse or their boss to determine their future. They take charge of it. And that is something that can be role modeled through storytelling.
Ooh, but now you've hit one of my big buttons. You know, the number of times that I've been out in the world working with Latinos and have been told that we are, at our core, fatalists, makes me want to rip my hair out. Because what I want to say to them is, if you are an indigenous woman living in the middle of nowhere and you are diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, is it fatalism that you say you are going to die? Or is it pragmatism because of where you live and what you have access to? And I think that that is a really important distinction to make, that fatalism means that despite the options available to you, you will not look at them, and you will not take advantage of them, and you will not exercise them. That's fatalism.
Agreed.
I think practically looking at what is not available to you, understanding clearly that the forces, however they come to you, God, divine, whatever, are stacked against you, that to me is pragmatism. So, sorry.
Well, it makes me think of a dear friend of mine who lives in India and is a classical dancer, but she's retelling the classical stories of India. through the eyes of the female victims, because there are many, many female victims in Indian classical myth. And so her art is the retelling of the story. So, Del, in terms of fatalism mm-hmm. in Latino culture, is there anyone doing a reframing, retelling of the stories? It's an interesting question and kind of an interesting theme we're on.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at, you know, sort of the origin stories, if you look at indigenous stories, if you look at dances that have been done in terms of the gods and the positions of Mexicans prior to the arrival of the Spaniards, then there really was a different relationship between the human and God. I think what happens when people become victims is because the power dynamic really changes. And so it is with the arrival of the Spaniards that, you know, what went on in Mexico really changed. And so I think part of is someone reclaiming and retelling, mm-hmm. absolutely. I mean, you see it in Mexico and regions of Latin America, in film, in music, in what is being written. I think you see it in barrios in Los Angeles with wall art and with kids that are doing hip-hop, mm-hmm. and they're really putting, you know, thoughts to words, and they're galvanizing their communities, and they're taking back mm-hmm. power and a real mm-hmm. understanding that they can control
exactly,
what's going
that's
on.
Exactly, that's exactly where that comes from, right? Right. Helping people individual. Claim right. their power. So the audience is wondering about young children. We haven't talked about young children among those most vulnerable, and I'll combine two questions, which is, well, just, you know, thoughts or perspective on young children, and then how are we using storytelling, if at all, in schools to reach children at a very early age and start reframing, retelling, and creating power?
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I mean, I'm happy to talk to you.
Well, and then I want
I don't
to
know if I have much intelligence to add on this, but clearly this is an area of huge controversy within the American society. I have seen people become almost apoplectic over the mention of children's rights if they happen to be parents, because they think basically they own this kid and they have the right to do what they need to do to raise them as they see best. And obviously, because we have hundreds of thousands of children in foster care, my wife and I know this world a little bit, because we raised a girl from age 12 who came out of foster care, raised her to adulthood, so we got exposed to that world. There is a huge need to instill in people, and particularly in people entering parenthood, the concept of how to raise their children and whether or not they are indeed personally equipped to be parents. One has to be licensed to be a foster parent, but one does not have to be licensed to be a parent. And I'm not suggesting we institute that, but there's certainly a huge need for education to make people better parents, because so much violation of human rights occurs with young children. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers and those things may be helping children to some extent, but still, when they're pre-6 years old or pre-7 years old, they're not in a position to assert their rights with their parents.
As a parent, the slight divergence that I take on this is that I feel like I worked very hard. I raised a son, and God was in his mercy when he didn't give me a girl, because I probably would not have done as well. But that I worked so hard to really try and hope that my son had the ability to see himself as a competent human in the world, that he could he could stand up for himself, he could say, and then he got to be a teenager out in the world, and he was going to be away from me. And I got to tell you that a brown boy out in the world who might confront the police mm-hmm. is a very different thing. And all those messages that I gave to him about standing up for himself and holding his ground really just melted into nothingness when I really thought about what he might confront out in the world and how I needed to try and change that message to say, Seb, for survival, for self-preservation, suck it up, honey. Even if it's a challenge that just burns in the belly, don't do it. Now, that's a horrible message to give a child. But I felt that I had no option, because then I was going to make him vulnerable in a different way. And that seemed unconscionable as a parent.
And I would say, too, that how we define a child, I mean, obviously, there's the UN. It's a child, and you know, at 18, but that, you know, it can get very gray. Yeah. And, you know, people expect that suddenly someone's 18, that they're totally not vulnerable anymore. And you can talk about this in foster care, or you can talk about it in trafficking, or you can talk about it in other sort of, you know, in health and all sorts of things. But the fact is that, you know, there's vulnerability at every age. And at the teenage years, you know, some of my work was looking at rites of passage and these states of liminality where people are going through transitions. And in some traditional societies, you know, they still have those in Africa and South America and Asia. And we have them here in birthdays and all sorts of things. But, you know, we're losing them a lot. So a lot of these young people don't have these rites of passages. And what happens is they're incredibly vulnerable because of that. Their status is questioned. They haven't become this sort of, they don't know what adulthood means. And so there is a lot of questions of vulnerability around that. And I think that public education has, no, not necessarily has to be the parent role in this, but there is a right to, there's a role it can play in protecting vulnerable people in schools and talking to people about empathy, in helping, you know, helping kids understand that the difference in other kids and understanding that and increasing that, I think, over the next, 20, 30 years as we are becoming more mixed but also becoming more afraid. And I think that that's really important, particularly with the younger generation. I have two very young boys, very, very, very young. And already I think it's going to be tough because, this world is, for all genders and all races, it is going to be difficult to... I think, protect each other and protect ourselves, so we have to be as empathetic as possible.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of audience interest in the question of human trafficking, so from a student, Mei Ling, probably, are there certain groups in our countries that you find are more commonly trafficked than others? And from another audience member, what are the laws around human trafficking?
Oh gosh. There are federal trafficking laws that Homeland Security and the U.S. government has enacted, but there's also statewide. Colorado had some of the worst, and now it has some of the strongest in terms of prosecution. In terms of the most vulnerable groups, that shifts, but we're talking groups that are, you know, vulnerable. Migrants, undocumented migrants, runaways, young women. I am doing a big investigation right now about... sex trafficking, but I can't really talk about the case right now because it's a big story, but I'm doing one on sex trafficking, and it's really difficult. I've never done one on sex trafficking because it's so hard to hear. And I'll tell you that it is not one type of woman or one type of young girl, but abuse has, when a lot of these women start very young, and but it's all socioeconomic brackets. So there isn't one type of group. But some of the things that do draw them together is there is issues around the support network they had at a young age. And that increases their vulnerability and the relationships they've had. But you can have the best family and still get involved in it. That's not to say that hasn't happened, but a lot of people start off very vulnerable. And so the first man that loves them, the first person that says, come on this trip, the first person that does these things, they go. And it's just because of the way they perceive themselves. But, you know, it's very broad, and I'm really happy to talk to people afterwards about it in more in depth. But, you know, there are laws, and there's international, and there's national, and there's statewide laws. But at the same time, it's still a really, really hidden field where, you know, the food you eat and the clothes you wear and the people who work and clean these buildings, you know, you don't know. It's not uncommon. It's actually very common.
While there's no magic bullet, this is another area where communications can make a difference. We had a collaboration with Ben and Jerry's to do a soap opera in Cote d'Ivoire, Mali, and Burkina Faso, and then Niger, to try to stop the use of child slave labor in the cocoa industry in Ivory Coast. And there are hundreds of thousands of kids, according to UNICEF, who get offered a high-paying job in Ivory Coast, and their parents let them go for a $20 down payment, and then they disappear. And they are used 18 to 20 hours a day as slaves. They're shot if they try to leave. They're given enough food to survive. They're not allowed to go to school. And so Ben and Jerry said, let's see if we can affect this. So we did a soap opera. And one of the great things that came out of it was parents, as well as adolescents who were tempted to go off to seek their fortune in the Ivory Coast, learned, oh my God, if you go off with somebody who's promising you a job, you may end up as a slave. And in fact, we did an inline survey that showed that interventions to stop somebody from being trafficked had doubled among our listeners.
Can I just add one thing, though? But we have to provide them alternatives. Yeah. And I think that whether we talk about the decrease in species, we need to address the global south and poverty. Yeah. When we talk about child labor, we talk about we have to give them alternatives. And I'm just curious to like what you guys talk about.
In fact, in the storyline, we did. We had two young boys, one of whom took a job in somebody's store and continued his studies, even though living in poverty, and the other one who said, screw this, I'm going off to get a high-paying job in the Ivory Coast. And so we showed their two lives and what happened to them.
We have a beautiful question from an audience member, and I would love to take time for each of you to answer if you would. And it says, all of you on the panel work with those who have been cruelly treated by those who show little or no empathy from very callous people. Has this given you a jaundiced view of humanity? Or has the victim's resilient, or have the victim's resilience given you a validation of our humanity?
Gosh, I'd have to say neither, or neither. I have certainly, you know, I worked a great deal in the U.S. South, and I work a lot with health centers, and I was in a health center where a physician pulled me aside and he said, listen, I don't know what to do with this, but every woman that I've seen today was raped in transit. I don't see them as particularly resilient, so it's not like I was able to take hope from their resilience. On the other hand, the mere statement that he was making and his look to me as if somehow I was going to be able to generate anything useful was not overwhelming. It did give me some hope that he, as a male physician, treating female patients with whom he could not easily communicate because he didn't speak any Spanish, still meant that he viewed their humanity, meant that as long as there's somebody else out there trying, then one way or the other, there is no choice but to keep putting one foot in front of the other, because what else is there to do? So I am neither emboldened nor am I defeated, but then I'm not dead either. So, you know, that's not quite romantic enough, I guess, but that's really my perspective.
I think I oscillate between utter despair and complete just callousness towards my husband complaining about dinner that night. I get into this world where I'm talking to someone on the phone for 2 hours and they're telling me about, you know, from when they were 10 and they got trafficked to Vegas and they got raped repeatedly. And, you know, I don't listen to it dispassionately. I probably am too close. But then they are then talking to their baby in the background and they have recovered and they are in peer recovery and they start their own survivors network. And I'm just like, that is the most incredible thing. And I'm very careful not to patronize people about, wow, you're so strong and you're such a survivor and like, wow, I couldn't do that or something. But at the same time, I just listen and I absorb it. And I think that I don't look to save people at all. I don't know, maybe there's a bit of me that feels that I can do something. But I think that there's this idea that, you know, these people are saving themselves and I want to report that, you know. And I think that when we talk about narrative and storytelling, it is, I just wanted to add this before, was that as a journalist, you can embed the victim narrative or you can take people out of the victim narrative. And things like human trafficking, you know, you can just ask about all the terrible things that happened to them in gruesome and lurid detail, and then you can walk away and print that. Or you can actually talk to them and ask them to put that in their whole, you know, a wider world story, okay, about the way in which they have found other things or what they're trying to do with their life or who they love and who their family is, you know. We are not our own singular stories. We are many constellations of stories. And I think when you do like difficult stories like this, you need to give people, just like you would talk to a friend or your family, that ability to tell many stories. So, yes, both, I think.
Bill, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I think that Woody Allen was right when he said most of the world's problems could be solved if men were constantly hooked up to an orgasmatron. But having said that, certainly I believe people are neither good nor evil for the most part, but they belong on a, or appear on a spectrum. And, you know, I've witnessed horrible stuff, and I've witnessed really heroic stuff by people. And I do believe that people are reformable, at least to a certain extent, and through interventions that create alternative role models and alternatives that work for people, they can go from very negative behaviors to more positive behaviors. But I think humanity has a very long way to go to get to the point that we're not having this kind of conversation.
I will tell you that the audience mood is to turn to solutions a little bit more, so let me let you know that not yet, but soon I'm going to ask you the question people are asking: what organizations are doing good work, where can we give money, how can we help? So that's coming. But in the meantime, let me pair two questions from you. One is, what can we do to help homeless people? That's something I know a huge amount about. And another of our audience members reminded us on April 19th, there is a hearing on Capitol Hill in Denver on the right to rest law, and that would be a first step in decriminalizing homelessness. So if whoever made mention of that hearing, could pair with anyone else who's interested in the topic of decriminalizing homelessness, perhaps you could meet up and talk a little bit more. There's also someone who asked a question, and probably in the moment it was said, what might be the impact of taking a personal oath? Some of you talked about that, if it was taken and publicized by a great number of people in a community. Matt Nicodemus, do you need to elaborate on that, or panelists, do you have the reference for your question? Yeah, what might be the impacts of such a personal oath if it was taken and publicized by a great number of people in a community? Okay, so directing back, if people took that personal oath, would that make a difference?
What kinds of differences would that
make? I think there's all sorts of ways that people can come together now more than ever. Money is one way, but I think just people talking together and having a sense of empathy for people different from them is really important. I think also that communities that are more outsiders can feel more inside. You know, I know I live in Longmont, just outside of Boulder, and you know, I know that there was a big swell of support for the Hispanic community, for example, after the EO came out. So, you know, I think that people can show how they feel in many ways, and in Oath maybe one of those ways. But I think as a journalist, for example, you know, I feel that my job is to give people not just informed choices, but real stories about real people that they can see are universal. So that's my role, I think.
So continuing that theme of personal empowerment, and perhaps without endorsements, I don't know the CWA rules about endorsing, but what organizations do you think are doing good work? Where would you give your money? Where would you give your time? Are there personal strategies for combating the kind of vulnerability we've been talking about?
I mean, I would say that you're all here, you know, you're educating yourselves, and I think that if you're interested in any of these topics, if you're interested in an issue, whether it's homelessness or human trafficking, that you look locally, but also read about it, and go to these organizations that will be local. There are some chapters in Boulder and in Denver, because it's everywhere. All these things, homelessness and poverty and trafficking, and that one advice I would give you: don't give money. Okay, go and meet people that are affected first. Because even though you may be affected in a kind of very personal and you're empathetic and in a remote way and you could read a story, actually meeting those people will give you a better insight. And I think that that is just that one-to-one meeting possibility, which would be incredibly powerful for you as an individual, that will have a far more far-reaching, lasting effect on you to organize and to educate than just giving money. That's what I would say, anyway.
But if you do want to give money and you're looking at organizations, then study the organization. Yeah. You know, there's the Charity Navigators. I mean, there's a number of resources where they try and tell you how much of the money that they collect goes to administration and where they're really directing their funds. I mean, there's, you know, and it depends on the topic that you're concerned with. If you're concerned with prison reform, then there's groups like Cure International where less than 2% of the money that they give goes to administration. I mean, you can really teach yourself about the topics that are important to you and the organizations that seek to affect it, and then make an informed choice about however you want to deploy your resources.
Bill?
Dell said what I was about to say, but certainly I think educating yourself on the effectiveness of any organization you're considering supporting can include getting to know people, although when you're dealing with international organizations where their headquarters or their operations may be at some distance, it may be less practical than when you're talking to local organizations. But even then, I think contacting their headquarters and asking some questions and looking at Charity Navigator and looking at their website and looking at the data on effects, and ultimately, to the extent that they measure this, looking at their cost effectiveness is really important, because many organizations do things that sound good. They work in one village doing something. And yet, if you tried to take it to scale, it's impossible because of the cost. So ultimately, in a world of limited charitable resources, looking at organizations that are at scale or can go to scale at a level of cost that is manageable is ultimately the only way we can solve global problems.
And I would add, from my perspective, doing so much work with homeless people, folks ask me all the time, what should I do about the person, what we call flying a flag, standing on the street corner with a cardboard sign? And that's a much longer topic and an answer, but I always say, if you don't know what to do, at least smile. Acknowledge their humanity. Acknowledge that they're there. It's okay if you don't know or haven't found your mind in that moment. Smile at them. don't pretend that they're not there on the corner, because they watch you pretend that they're not there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we are at 6:09, and panelists, if you each did 2 minutes of wrap-up, we would end right on time. Anyone have closing thoughts? Want to?
No. My thoughts are really disorganized.
It's a real
brain kind of falls apart.
It's a really, I would say, it's a really big topic, and you've all made it much, much bigger. Yeah, sure. So if you didn't have,
well, I have one. But you know, the other thing, I mean, when we talk about vulnerability and we're talking about giving money and we're talking about what actions we can take, what is truly the case is the United States is the 800-pound gorilla in almost every environment. Mm-hmm. They affect policies and practice and the deployment of money and everything the world over. So if you are concerned by the state of the world, then be really clear on the policies and the practices of this government. Be an informed citizen, register to vote, register other people to vote, and really vote with a complete and full understanding of the facts.
Mm. You did have a wrap-up.
You inspired me to say something. Yeah, I'll just add to that. You just inspired me to talk now. Just being civic-minded and civic media is really important. That means that we're allowed to make more democratic choices and everything right now. And if people are feeling powerless to help others that they feel are more vulnerable and things like that, I think it is about getting involved as a citizen and voting, but also really trying to get to know people. On an individual basis, I am a huge proponent of that. I think a lot of fear and racism and ethnocentrism starts when people don't know each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you were just to walk across the street, ask yourself, do you ever talk to your neighbor? Do you talk to the person in the cafe? Or are we just on our computers all the time? You know, people find it weird to say hello to people and strangers, right?
But I smile at people and they look at me very oddly.
Yeah, like, but you know, sometimes it's just, okay, it's not here about how to talk to people, but it is about context, but it is about that first engagement. And, you know, I think with all the fear going on at the moment and the partisanship, I think reaching out is probably the best thing that we could do to help everyone, really.
I'll just say that for me, it's been a thrill getting to know of the work of my fellow panelists. Mm-hmm. I have great admiration for the type of work they are undertaking, and I wish everybody in this room could be a panelist. I think if we had all day, we would have a fascinating discussion mm-hmm. of what each person here is doing to try to make society a better place. So I thank you.
Thank you.
There were just a couple of questions that were pretty narrow and targeted, so if your question got unanswered, panelists, do you have 5 minutes if somebody wants to grab you? And otherwise, another round of applause for a really fabulous panel.
Yay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I need to tell you, it was a radio
thank you.
That was fun. And I love it. I love to hear so much.
Look it up.